So we're continuing our study in 2 Samuel, and we are at a rather famous section of Scripture in 2 Samuel as we look at the life of David. We just finished up a section where, they kind of took over or conquered, rather, Ammon and Aram, and, so we kind of talked about that. You kind of see that area up there and kind of the right side, the east side of the Jordan. So we'll be talking a little bit about that. We'll also be talking about, let's see if my pointer works. No? Oh, I'll turn it on. Woo! It's a long day, long day. All right, so we're talking about this area, but we'll be talking about, where to go? Where to go? Rabbath, right here. This is a capital royal city. And if you can read that, if you have your quadfocals, anyway, if you can read that, that's kind of small print, I'm sorry. But that's a city that we'll be mentioning. I find that it kind of helps put things in perspective when we start naming cities and going through places to have a picture in our minds about what we're looking at. If you've read Narnia or any of the Chronicles or anything like that, and you have a map beside you, you got to have a map to kind of know what you're talking about. So it's the same kind of thing here. Having this map helps us. So as we progress along, we're down into David's great sin in chapter 11, and so we'll be starting there tonight. As we open up this chapter, we have sort of this event. Then it happened in the spring, so it's springtime, at the time when the kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbath. But David stayed in Jerusalem. All right, so here's this time stamp. It's springtime, which is the time when the flowers bloom and the trees bud, and we go out to war, apparently, according to this passage. What does this say in relationship to what normally happens and what David does? What normally happens? You go out to war. What does David do? He stayed home. He sent, right? So he's staying back. So he sends Joab, the commander of his armies, and his servants out to go fight. And so he stays back. He should have gone. And they go out to Ammon, as we looked at, which is about 40 miles east of Jerusalem. So this is a capital city. So basically you have the war of two capitals. They had fought with them previously. They've been a thorn in their side previously. And so now they're going out to fight against them again. And so you have this situation where you know, it's kind of dangerous to have two capitals so close to each other, right? I mean, you could throw a rock, figuratively speaking, at the other capital. There's going to be some issues. And so David takes this time to go over, or send at least people over to capture this city. Now, David's at home, can't sleep, verse 2, right? Now, when evening came, David rose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof, he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. That has been the demise of a lot of people. But here is a situation where he's not sleeping, right? We know the story, right? What happens? What unfolds with this story? Apparently, right, he's not saying, well, that's beautiful. God's creation is beautiful. It's not what he's saying in this situation, is it? No, he's looking on her. Now, what she's doing on the roof, bathing, you know, none of you guys bathe on the roof, I don't think, in regularly, nobody? Okay, so obviously house structures are different. You do bathe on the roof? I'm sorry. Okay.
That's not how I see it. I see him walking around the roof and she's down on the ground. But what I didn't get, mm-hmm. What are they doing living next to the king?
Yeah, David's city, yeah, if you look at David's city, the city of Jerusalem and where he was, we're not talking about a huge area. And if he has an elevated house at all, you can see other people's rooftops, right? So I imagine in my mind that's kind of what, and also rooftops were flat. They used those as places. And and it's probably a situation where she is probably ceremonially bathing for a cleansing. There's ladies have to do that after, you know, once a month to cleanse themselves. So that may be something that's happening in this situation. It is at night. Maybe she wasn't taking into consideration, oh, the king's house is a couple stories taller than mine. I don't know. We don't know. The moon was particularly bright that night. Don't know. We don't know all the details as to how he could see her, but the text tells us that he did. You have a comment?
She was the wife of one of his best fighters.
Yes, we're getting there. You're skipping ahead. So we're getting there and just, yeah, yeah.
Close to the king's house, probably.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, and we'll get Uriah, which is, this is Bathsheba, is Uriah's wife. Go ahead.
The verse doesn't say she was on the roof, though.
What does it say?
That he was on the roof. She was just bathing somewhere.
Okay.
They didn't have windows back then either, probably.
Like, no, I personally, just I've always had it in my mind that she was on the roof bathing, yeah. As far as the structure of houses and that kind of stuff, for him to be able to see her, unless he's, you know, peeping through the curtains. We don't know. It could be that as well. So we see this unfolding. He sees her. And so David inquires of who is this woman. So it's not a situation where he just sees her and turns away. He is curious. He wants to know more. Now, you know, in a situation where he could have accidentally saw her and turned away, that would have been probably appropriate thing to do. Reading between the lines here, we don't know. It doesn't appear that he did that necessarily. She stayed in his mind, and he asked about her, which was dangerous, right? If we're opening the door to sin, would that have been the next best step? So he's kind of inviting trouble, trying to figure out who this person is. And so he does. He inquires of her. It says, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah? Both of these guys are mentioned among David's top 30 fighters. His heavy hitters, his mighty men, mentioned in chapter 23. Both of these guys. So this is the daughter of one of his mighty men and the wife of one of his mighty men. Yeah, I mean, it's not like they had, like, social... I don't know that they had, like, social events. They had a ball. Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of close warriors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
The lesson is
that... Yeah, it is possible that he could have been... Yeah, I mean, it's possible that he's up on the roof. It's possible he knows that the women are probably going to be bathing in the evening... for cleansing purposes. We can read between the lines on that. We don't know. He didn't take the right course in this situation. He should have been in battle. If he'd have been doing the work he's supposed to be doing, then none of this would have happened, right? So we learn a lesson here as far as sin and it's what's happening with David. Now, what does he do? He sends messengers to get her, right? And then in verse 4, he laid with her. And when she purified herself from her cleanness, she returned to her house. Right out there beside that Leviticus 15:18, as far as purified from her uncleanliness. Leviticus 15:18. We're not going to go into it. I'll let you look that up and read it. But that's probably what's going on. Verse 5, what happened? Oops. Yeah. Oops. How does that work? So she gets sends message, I'm pregnant. And you know, he's like, oh man. So what does he do? Let's just talk about this. What does he do in order to cover this, to cover his tracks? Well, initially what does he do? He sends for Uriah, right? He wants Uriah to come home. What's Uriah going
to
do? What does he think Uriah is going to do when he comes home? What does he hope? Yes, that he'll kind of hang out with his wife, right? And, you know, all this will be, you know, like it never happened, right? But pesky Uriah. What does he do? So he sends for Uriah, and Uriah came, and David asked about the state of the war. And David said, go down to your house and wash your feet. And Uriah went out of the king's house in the presence of the king, and he went out after him. But Uriah slept where? Oh. Didn't work. It didn't work. Do you think David felt like, oh man, now what? Now what do we do? And so the next phase, he's told that Uriah did not go down to his house. And so David said, Uriah, have you not gone down to your house for your journey? Why don't you go down to your house? And what does Uriah say in verse 11? Verse 11, what does Uriah say to David? Now remember, he's not an Israelite, this guy. He's not an Israelite. Yes, you start adding up time frame. We're not, you know, this isn't like the next day.
I think it takes a few weeks to find out if you're pregnant. I'm not that.
I don't know. You can ask around later if you want to find out some information on that. I would Google it. But we're talking about some time between these things unfolding here. And it's important to kind of think about that as you read the text. Because as we read verse to verse, we're thinking next day. She found out. How'd she find out so quickly? Right, so it's a very good point. And Uriah, you know, as far as the time's ticking on Uriah being down there and, you know, all the, you know, everything lining up correctly. The mechanics, yes, of all of this.
She went back to her house, which makes you think that she didn't go back to see David again.
The text lends us to believe that she did not go back to see David, that she did go back to her house. We don't have all the information, but it leads us to believe that it was a one-time event. And so Uriah is saying, how can I go? The ark is, you know, how can I go? He's on this moral high, you know, and doing what he thinks is right. The army is out there fighting, which, you know, he said, shall I go? And it says, shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? And he says, no, he's not going to do that. Which, you know, where should David have been? He should have been out in battle too. I'm wondering, you know, me personally, I wonder if there's like some anxiety in the ranks. David should be out here with us fighting. And Uriah comes back and said, how can I go do that? You know, and so Uriah to go back with his comrades, are going to be like, oh, well, you got to go home, la-di-da. And so there may be some of that in there. We don't know. But so here is the situation. Uriah is presenting a troublesome time for David. And so then he invites Uriah over, and they drink, and he became drunk, and he still did not go down to his house. Even in his drunkenness, he still did not go down to his house. And so what is the next course of action? Uriah is not going down to his house. What's the next course of action? Sends him back to battle with a letter in his own hand that he has no idea is his own death sentence. That's pretty low, right? That is really low. I mean, if they had carrier pigeons or something like that, I might have tried to do it. It just seems really low to send a man with his own death warrant out. But what's going to happen is he's asked the commander of the army to put Uriah at a particularly treacherous place in the line, and then to make a symbol, and everybody, you know, take a step back, three steps, and allow him basically to be sacrificed to the cause. Which, again, psychologically, what does Joab think? My commander, the man after God's own heart, is asking me to do this thing. And then you kind of have to coordinate with other guys, right? You can't just, you know, you got to coordinate with other people maybe. And so it begins to, this mess that has been made by David starts getting bigger and bigger, just a bigger mess. Is he correcting anything? Is he correcting anything? He's making it worse. He's making it worse, right? So there's a course of action should have been to ask for forgiveness, but that apparently was not the course of action David chose. And so he goes out, and he gets the message, And so they go close to the city. And so Joab kept watch on the city and put Uriah in the place where he knew where there would be valiant men. That means it'd be a tough battle. And the men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Now this is interesting in verse 19. He charged a messenger saying, "When you have finished telling all the events of the war to the king, and if it happens that the king's wrath rises, and he says to you, 'Why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck down Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall, and he died in Thebes?'" So this is from Judges 9, which incidentally, if you read Judges 9, 50 through 54, the guy wanted somebody else to kill him. Abimelech wanted somebody else to kill him so he would not be remembered for being killed by a girl. But David's bringing it up right here. He gets remembered for being killed by a girl. So here's the thing. When you are in battle, you do not go up to people who are too close and have high ground and have things they can shoot at you. Just, you know, these are tactics 101. And so that's what he's saying. But what was supposed to appease, David in this message? If he got sort of testy about the message, what was supposed to appease him? That Uriah died. Silver lining, Uriah died. Okay? Now, who else, when we look at this text, was it just Uriah that died? When you read this text, when they went up close, and you know, basically they went up close to the gates, and the men of the city came out to fight them, and then they pushed back the men of the city up close to the gates. They started shooting arrows at the men of Israel, and not just Uriah died. So who is there? Are other other casualties to this event, other than just Uriah, other than what David intended? And so this message goes to the king. And we see in verse 24 that so some of the king's servants died, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead. And look at verse 25. It's very interesting. "Then David said to the messenger, 'Thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this thing displease you or trouble you, for the sword devours one as well as another.'" What is David doing? He thinks, all right, this is closed. This chapter is done. He's dead. I will assuage the conscience of Joab and just say the sword devours who it wills. You know, you're going to have collateral damage in battle. This is, everybody swore an oath. They know that going in. All those kind of things you hear in movies, right? So he says that sort of to kind of appease Joab in this situation. Yeah. Yeah, Joab's probably confused about what's going on with David. And is David really assuaging Joab, or is David assuaging his own conscience, maybe? That may be a little bit of what's happening as well. Yes, sir?
Joab has his armies.
Correct. If Joab wants to come back and cause trouble because of this incident, he probably could have. So there's several thoughts about that. So it's over, right? In verse 26, the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead. She mourns. How long she mourns, we don't know, but it talks about a specific time. It could have been as little as seven days. It could have been a month. If you want to write out there Deuteronomy 21:13, that could be an example as far as the time frame of mourning. And David brought her to the house, and she became his wife. Okay, and so according to David, it's done, right? You know, a few people know about the king's secrets, but in general, the people, the populace, do not know about what's going on. Enter God. Verse chapter 12, we have Nathan. "Then the Lord said to Nathan," sent Nathan to David, sorry, "and said to him, 'There were two men.'" All right, we heard the story. What happens? What story does Nathan tell to David? Talks about little ewe lamb, right? Talks about sheep, which, you know, David understands sheep. Does David understand sheep? He knows sheep. He knows about sheep. And so we have basically a story of people in these two guys in the city, one who has just all kinds of sheep, another guy who has one ewe lamb that's precious to him. I mean, so precious. What does it say? What does it use? What words does it use here to explain how precious this ewe lamb is to this guy? What's that?
Ate
his own food. How many of you have a ewe lamb at home? I mean, a four-legged beast that eats your food. Any of you guys? Some of you do. Some of you are not raising your hand. You're not admitting the fact that you have pets. That's fine. I understand. So this is something that's very, very close. An animal that's very close to him, right? And what happens to this animal? The rich guy took him and served him as though it was no big deal to some guests that came, right? Just kind of took him and killed him. And David, probably, you know, maybe as a child had a little ewe lamb that was a pet. You know, maybe this harkens back to some early pangs that we don't know about. But so what is David's response to this? He's a little upset, right? He's upset. Then David's anger burned greatly against the man. He said to him, "As the Lord lives, sure this man who has done this deserves to die. He must take make restitution for the lamb fourfold." And then Nathan, what does he say? Yeah, this is a big deal, right? This is a big deal. So Nathan says to David, this could go one of two ways for Nathan, right? He's got to say this. This is the message from God. He's got to say it, or it'll be visited upon him. So he has to say it. But he says, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel." And I don't imagine that Nathan says this sort of in a calm, nonchalant, "Oh, by the way, this is you, David. God said." Do you think he said it that way? I don't imagine. The way the text reads, I don't imagine that he said it just sort of, you know, nonchalant. "You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel. It is I who anointed you king over Israel. It is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. I also gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your care. And I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have done more for you." And what does he say? Well, how does God, what is the message that Nathan gives to him? What are the circumstances? What happens? He tells him the facts. Exactly. So God gave him this message and told him all that he had done. Even that he said, "Even if that would have been too little, I would have done more for you. I would have done more for you." And so this is something that unfolds. He says, "Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon. And so now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes to give them to your companion, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. And indeed you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and under the sun." Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." So here is what's going to happen. These are the consequences of what's going to happen. And we're going to see that this happens very quickly. This starts to unravel very quickly. He says, Nathan said to David, "The Lord also has taken away your sin. You shall not die. However, because by this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born to you shall surely die." And so Nathan goes home after delivering this message. If you want to write, Psalm 51 has a heading. Psalm 51 has a heading that is placed here. Again, the headings are come along much later. We don't know necessarily, but it is possible that Psalm 51 was written after hearing on this occasion. It is possible. But it is a psalm that says, "Create in me a clean heart, O God." It's just this repentance from David in this psalm. So it is possible that it was written at this time. To close out chapter 12, we have this child dies. The child is struck with a sickness, and it dies. But David, how does he react if you want to open up your Bible and kind of give me the cliff notes, how does David react to, or what does David do when this child becomes sick and is nigh unto death? How does he respond? He's grieving. He's mourning. He's inquiring of the Lord that if there be any sort of possible way that this would not happen. And how are the people? He's grieving so much, and the people around him are like, man, if he dies, if this child dies, how much worse could David get? I mean, well, what is he going to do when he finds out the child dies? So when the child does die, what do they do? You're like, you go tell him. No, you go tell him. I'm not going to tell him. I told him last time. You go. So they don't want to tell David because of the state that David's in. They're afraid of what David will do if he finds out. And he hears them whispering, and he asks, what's going on with the child? Is it alive, or did it die? And they said, it died. And how does he react? After mourning and grieving, how does he react after the child dies? What's that? It's seemingly he was, you know, in the right place. He gets up, bathes, anoints himself with oil, changes clothes, and goes to get something to eat because he hasn't eaten in a while. And everybody's astonished. What are they expecting David to do? To be worse, right? He may be suicidal. We have no idea what they're expecting him to do, but worse than what he was. They did not expect this. And they ask him, what is this thing that you've done? While the child was alive, you fasted and wept, but when the child died, you arose and ate food. And he said, while the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who knows, the Lord may be gracious to me, but that the child may live. But now that he has died, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I will go to him, but he will not return to me. When will David go to this child?
When he dies.
So David's in the right place. David understands about what's going on. Now, does it hurt? I'm sure it does. Loss always hurts. But he's mentally in the right place. He understands that he will go to him, but the child will not return back to David. Verse 24, we have an interesting person is born. Who's born in 24 and 25? Solomon. And David comforted his wife. So Bathsheba, obviously, Bathsheba's lost her husband. Bathsheba has lost the child she had with David. And they have another son. She gave birth to Solomon, whose name means peace, Solomon's real name, if you want to pronounce it in the Hebrew way, is Shlomo, which doesn't sound as kingly, you know, does it? I don't know if you guys like that name or not. We'll just keep it Solomon, but the Hebrew way does not sound anything like this Anglicanized way. But the Lord loved him and sent word through Nathan, the prophet, and he named him Jedidiah for the Lord's sake. It means beloved by the Lord. So we have this snippet of the birth of Solomon, which, by the way, we'll get to this in a second, hopefully. Yes, sir. Yeah, we don't really see any timestamps in here really that give us any clues. It, like you're saying, it does sound like it was pretty quick, but we don't know. We guesstimate. I have no idea. We don't really don't know. But you're right. It does sound like it's pretty quick after the child's birth.
Based on verse
20. No. I don't think it was. I mean, she had to go through a purification process before any of that could have happened. So, so there was some time after. We don't know. Maybe as soon as a year, probably. Probably, I don't know. We're guessing here at this point. I'm sorry. No, I mean, as far as like how old the child was when the child died, we don't know.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Yep. But we don't know. But it's a very good question. It does seem very soon afterwards. So First Chronicles it actually kind of picks up here. We have, just to give you an idea, First Chronicles chapter 20, verse 1, kind of coincides with like the first verse of chapter 11. And then all these events that we have here from chapter 11 and chapter 12, most of chapter 12, take place between verses 1 and 2 of 1 Chronicles chapter 20. So 1 Chronicles it was really a Cliff Notes version of a lot of these kind of things, and they leave out some information. So just if you're wanting to kind of put information in there to kind of make sort of a harmony between 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles, that's what's going on. So 1 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 1 or 2 kind of picks up here at verse 26. And we see that Joab is still fighting at Rabbah, the sons of Ammon, and captured the royal city. And here's an interesting note that I have even captured the city's waters. So this city is a very difficult city to take. It is in a mountainous region. It's very well fortified. There's some archaeological evidence that supports that even the water source had a citadel around it. So the fact that he's saying he's even taken the water source means he's at the point to you know, just the death strike to this city. And so he calls David and says, if you want your name on any of this, you need to come over here. And so David goes, they go, and he says, I will capture the city myself, and I will be named after me if you don't get over here, is what Joab says. So David gathered all the people, and they went to Rabbah and fight against the captured. They took the crown of the king on his head, and its weight was a talent of gold, which is about 67 pounds. If a talent is the Babylonian talent, the measure of weight, a 67-pound crown of gold. How many of you want a hat that's that heavy? I don't even want a backpack that's heavy, personally. Yeah, it's basically like a child sitting on your head, which I don't know how you know that, Dirk. But anyway, so it was, and it even had a precious stone on it. So hey, that's a. this is basically tells of the wealth of this city. This was a very wealthy city. They took a lot out of it, and then whenever they leave that city, that what do they do to the inhabitants of the city, and then the rest of the cities? What do they do? It doesn't sound like they just kind of like, they didn't go peacefully into the night, these people. They were sawn under saws and sharp iron instruments, torn with axes, and made them pass through the brick kiln. And he did this to all the cities. We don't know why, maybe striking fear into the sons of Ammon and hopefully making it easier to fight the other cities. We don't know. That's what happened in that situation. Now, chapter 13, we have a situation with Ammon and Tamar. And I want to make a note right here. If you want to write out 2 Samuel chapter 3, verses 2 through 5, talk about David's oldest sons. As far as his oldest son, Amnon is the oldest. Then Shelib, which we don't hear anything about again. So it's possible that he died. We don't know. We never hear anything about him. Then we have third is Absalom, and then Adonijah. So Amnon is the oldest. And all of these sons that are mentioned are with, so same father, different mother, all these children. And so Amnon the chapter 13 opens up with the fact that Absalom has a sister who is rather beautiful, Tamar. And Amnon, the son of David, loved her. And was so frustrated because of his sister Tamar that he... And so there's this idea that he's just pawning and pining after Tamar and in this text. And he wants to be with her and he can't be with her. And is what we're getting from this information. Then this guy comes along, a friend of Amnon, Jonadab. And he tells him, hey, you know what? Just go pretend like you're sick. Ask David to send Tamar to make some food for you, make you some grub, and then, you know, see what kind of unfolds, right? And so that's exactly what Amnon does, because he says, because he's told, I'm in love with Tamar, the sister of my brother Absalom. This is when he's saying he's going to do this. And so he does that. David did send Tamar to do that very thing. And at the point where she's making the food, he sends everyone out. In verse 9, he says, have everyone go out for me. And so everyone went out. And that's when he takes the food back into the bedroom, which, you know, to the inner room is what it says. And that's where he basically violates Tamar in that situation. He says to her, he asks for her to come lay with her, and she does not. Leviticus 20, verse 17. Leviticus 20, verse 17 tells us that if you were to look on the nakedness of your sister, or even in this case, half-sister, that you were to be banished. And so she's saying the right thing. This does not need to happen. This does not need to happen in Israel. And so this is what takes place. Incidentally, if you look over in Genesis chapter 20, verse 12, Genesis chapter 20, verse 12, Abraham and Sarah were related the same way, where they had this same exact sort of lineage. So Sarah was Abraham's half-sister in Genesis chapter 20, verse 12. But at this time, in this setting, Leviticus tells us that this was no longer acceptable practice. And so she's telling them that should not happen. So he does this thing with her. And then verse 15, after that happened, he was very angry with her. And so it says, the text tells us that he got very angry, a great hatred. A hatred which was hated her was greater than the love that he had for her, and he sends her away. We have no idea mentally what's going on with Amnon. No idea. But he's completely angry with her after this, and he sends her away. And she says, no, in verse 16, because this wrong, sending me away, is greater than what you had done to me. Trying to cover this up is going to create more issues than what you've already done. And so he sends her away, has somebody else take her away. Absalom finds out about this, and they keep silent for 2 years. Nothing happens for two full years. And then verse 23, Absalom creates a situation where all the sons of David come out. He says they have sheep shearers, and they're going to come out because he has sheep shearers. We don't know why it's that important that he has sheep shearers. It is possible that Absalom is offering to have all their sheep sheared, and while their sheep are being sheared, they celebrate, you know, this kind of this harvest of sorts. It's possible that's what they're talking about. We don't know what's going on culturally, why it's so important that David sort of tries to play it off, saying, no, there's going to be too many of us if we go out there and do that. Absalom insists. They go out, but we find out later on that this is a plot to kill Amnon, and he tells his servants, when I give you the high sign, kill Amnon. And don't worry about it. I told you to do it. So nothing's going to happen to you. They do that very thing. They kill Amnon. And all the sons of David get on their donkeys and start riding away. Because why? Hey, you might be next, right? This could be a coup. He could be annihilating all of the sons of David. So he's the only one left. And so they all ride away. Message comes very quickly to David that all of his sons had died. So he starts grieving. There are those who try to console him to tell him that no, not all of them have died. We don't know exactly what's going on. Then he finally gets the message that Absalom had killed Amnon and the rest are here. And so that tells us what happened. And so they have come back into the city. In verse 36, as soon as he had finished speaking, behold, the king's sons came and lifted their voices and wept. Also the king and all of his servants wept very bitterly. Now Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amnadab, king of Geshur. Geshur is now the area that we mentioned as far as where the Ammonites were. That's where Geshur is. And so that's in that same area. So he's fled. And so Absalom fled and gone to Geshur. And this was 3 years. So he's there for 3 years. So the events with Tamar happened, and then 2 years passed. And then this event unfolded, and then 3 years pass, and we have chapter 14, as we're coming in with the woman of Tekoa. So we see very quickly this counting off, as you're saying, counting off of the years. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Very right. Very right. This is part of, as Joe was saying, is part of this the sword not passing from David's house. This is where it starts. We have this huge, huge ordeal with the rebellion of Absalom and what unfolds. We see very quickly that he's a very skeeving, conniving individual, and we're going to see how this plot unfolds. So you'll see very quickly he's not the nicest of individuals. Any questions or anything before we close tonight? Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, in what way?
I mean, Uriah.
Yes.
So,
yep. Exactly. Very good point. What did David teach Absalom with the events with Uriah? That, hey, you know, you're in a place of power. If you want it, you can take it, apparently. So, again, God is letting that visit upon David, and the next generation are going to pay for what David's sin, what David did. Any questions, any further comments? All right, thank you very much for your time tonight. We'll start there next week.